What's the podcast?
Hey, this is Liz Wilson, co-host of Sif the Podcast. Welcome back to Pints and Puzzles.
Play me a podcast.
Hey, TJ, it's Celia. Just wanted to call and say how excited I am to hear some new episodes. Welcome back. And I need you to find an interesting story from my neck of the woods. All right, take care. Bye.
TJ, it's your UFO guy, Rob. I just wanted to call back and say I'm happy that you're back. You left us hanging there for a while. I almost couldn't. I had a tough time dealing with it, you know. So I started trying craft beers, and I don't like craft beers. I don't know why. You did this to me, TJ. You did this, but I'm happy you're back, man. Welcome back.
And that's right. We are officially back. Woo! There have been a lot of changes to Pints and Puzzles over the summer. Now, I won't bore you guys with them now, but in the future, I will have updates on pintsandpuzzles.com when I get it up and running. So, for now, just bookmark that site. That'll handle all this pre-roll stuff so we don't have to bore you with it ahead of time, and we can just get right to the show in most cases. All right. Also, a huge thank you to Liz, Celia, and Rob for those voicemails. I originally had those just for this Welcome Back episode, but you know what? I'm actually going to leave those open as a thing for people to leave messages, and hey, if they're fun, they might be used at the top of the show. Assuming they don't get deleted. Sorry, Jen. Okay, enough babbling. We have a show to do tonight.
Come on! Get to the show!
Tonight's story is one that is near and dear to my heart. And as such, I will admit right at the top of the show that my confirmation bias will be pretty clear during this episode. And frankly, I'm okay with that. It's definitely more of a mainstream case with a lot of information, but I've also been really familiar with the case for quite some time now, so maybe a little looser as far as episode format than usual. Either way, I'm going to do my best to condense the information in typical Pints and Puzzles fashion for you guys. See, this particular incident was one that was of major influence for me, kind of diving down the rabbit hole into the world of the strange and unusual. It was one of the first physical books I've ever owned on these type of topics as a kid or teenager. And since then, there's been multiple editions of that book, even a Hollywood adaptation of the event, and really there's a lot of parts of that movie that could still give me nightmares to this day. But without Travis Walton and his abduction story, you guys would all be listening to a very different podcast right now. And I wasn't the only one.
That's why the story broke in the news so profoundly all over the world, because it was a missing person story, possible homicide or murder story, right? And a UFO story, all in one. And people were trying to pick this case apart, trying to say, well, you know, what is it?
That was Jennifer Stein. Jennifer is the producer of the documentary film Travis, The True Story of Travis Walton. Jennifer and I had a fantastic conversation about her documentary, which you can get a copy of on TravisWaltonTheMovie.com, or you can check out a live screening of the movie with Jennifer and Travis on October 29th in the Bucks County region, and specifics around that event, as well as how to order the movie if you want your own copy, can be found on the website or a little bit later on in the show when we talk about it. Now, Jennifer has also spent a significant amount of time doing her own research on this case, so you'll be hearing from her a bit as I share with you guys one of the most compelling and honestly fascinating cases of UFO abduction that I've come across to this date. Welcome to the Travis Walton Experience.
What's the podcast? Find me a podcast. You miss me to my dad. Mother show is the best.
The logging team of 22-year-old Travis Walton, Ken Peterson, John Gillette, Steve Pierce, Alan Dallas, Dwayne Smith, as well as crew chief Mike Rogers, were all starting to wrap up their workday in the Apache Strigibbons National Forest in Arizona. I'm not even going to apologize for that.
That is the largest ponderosa pine forest in the world. It sits on a plateau that's 7,000 feet high. In November, it could easily be quite cold at night and snow. You could have heavy rains. There's dirt roads to get up there, and it's a switchback road. The most direct way, it's a switchback road that takes you 45 minutes to drive in a four-wheel drive vehicle. So that's not an easy feat.
So this is a pretty secluded area that was tough to access, and thus the guys wanted to get out of there before dark. As they were packing up for their drive home to Snowflake, Arizona, they noticed a strange glow from the tree line that some of them initially thought was the sunset. Thing is, on November 5th, 1975, the sun had set well before their 6 p.m. departure. So the crew decided to check it out and were astounded by what they saw. Before them was a literal flying saucer, about 15 to 20 feet in diameter. Now, as you would expect, the guys were scared shitless, but still intrigued enough not to leave the area. They were quickly broken out of their fixation by what Travis himself would later admit may not have been his brightest idea. Travis got out of the truck and went towards the object. He would later reflect both in his books and in Jennifer's documentary that this was basically a once-in-a-lifetime experience that he didn't want to pass up. He'll quickly regret that decision. The previously silent craft seemed to suddenly wake up, and there was a whirring noise from inside the craft, and a powerful beam shot out and hit Travis, picking him up off the ground and throwing him back down to the ground. Travis himself describes this hit as an electrical pulse almost that caused him extreme pain, and then he blacked out. As far as for the rest of the crew, this caused obvious initial panic. Before they could react, there was a sudden bluish beam that came out from the ship that picked Travis up and essentially took him away. So at this point, the crew went as fast as they could to get the hell out of there. And some people later on would judge this decision to get out of there so quickly. However, if you put yourself in those shoes, honestly, who could blame them? In their eyes, this strange object just randomly zapped their friend, possibly killing him, and then took him away. So who knows what their intentions were for the rest of the crew. So they got out of there as fast as possible. Now, Mike Rogers, who was the crew chief, he was also Travis's best friend. He came back later to look for signs of his friend, but at this point, he couldn't find anything, and they decided to get the authorities involved. So this is the part of the story where the story starts to split and you have two scenes happening kind of at the same time. Scene one is the events on the ground. You have a missing person, six of his friends slash coworkers saw him last. So naturally the first instinct is going to be to blame the rough guys with the chainsaws and the logging equipment for his disappearance. However, five of the six of them were able to successfully pass multiple polygraph tests with Dwayne Smith initially being ruled inconclusive, but later passing. Now, as an aside here, Dwayne had a somewhat checkered criminal past, and the speculation is that that's the reason that his test was ruled inconclusive, because he was nervous the first time. However, he did end up going to pass later on. Now, I also feel it's important to note here that I've listened to my fair share of true crime podcasts, and I'm well aware of the issues people have with the polygraph tests. So feel free to take this for however you wish. However, do keep in mind that all six of the guys, including Travis, have been tested multiple times over the years and have all passed every single time. Nonetheless, while the guys were being questioned, there was also a massive manhunt with police dogs, cadaver dogs, helicopters, the whole works. Yet no one was able to track Travis down, or his body for that matter. So this is one of the cool things about Jennifer's documentary. She was able to get interviews with the initial first responding officers, the deputy, the sheriff himself, Sheriff Gillespie, and these people are usually not as heard from in a lot of the YouTube videos and other documentaries you may have seen, but she was able to not only get them on camera, but she was also able to add a more human element to that, where quite honestly, when I was watching it, it looked like they were almost scared about what was going on, and they were definitely confused, and you could really see the human emotion in it by watching live interviews with these people.
The other interesting thing is when I interviewed the police detectives who were involved in the story, they were the sheriffs at the time, and both of them said, when you turn the camera off, I'll tell you some other interesting stuff.
So along with the sheriff's perspective, there was also some new evidence that was new to me when I talked to Jennifer, at least.
But in fact, when Tracy Torme, who produced the Paramount picture, when he was doing his investigations on site in 1993, he uncovered an FBI agent who had been on an adjacent hill the same night that this happened, camping with his wife. He was on a hunting trip, and he saw the ship. He saw the craft hovering on the adjacent hill. He was watching it like a hawk. He saw the whole forest light up, and about maybe 6 or 8 minutes after that, he saw the craft take off. And his upper said, well, let's you know, don't come forward yet because that your whole career is gone.
While all this was playing out on the ground, Travis was having his own experience aboard the craft that took him. Now, he goes into a lot of detail in his experience in his book and in the documentary, but I'm going to do my best to condense it a little bit here, so I'm just warning you right up front that this is the very condensed version of how he describes the events that happened to him. So when he woke up, he initially assumed he was in a hospital because there's a giant bright light above him, and there were these small beings in orange suits around him. Initially, Travis thought these were doctors. However, as he started to regain consciousness and his composure, he quickly realized these were not humans at all. Travis was scared and really not sure what to do, so he gained some adrenaline and tried to fight back with these strange beings. He reached over to the exam table and grabbed whatever he could to try to fight back. Surprisingly, these beings that Travis described as having pretty much no facial features except for these huge, dark, penetrating eyes, they quietly backed away from the clearly scared human. Seeing this as an opportunity to escape, Travis went out the opposite door, which led him to a room with what appeared to be some kind of navigation system. It was here he was greeted by two other beings that looked more human, and one was male and one was female. These beings were able to calm Travis down, get him back on the exam table, and they placed a small kind of breathing mask over him, which put him back right back under sedation. As I said, this is the condensed version of the story, but the two types of beings are really important, essentially in that they differed from the other famous UFO experience of Benny and Barney Hill that had more seemingly human elements to it, where it was more humans in a spacesuit kind of look. And they were definitely slightly more aggressive by nature. As an aside, if you are interested in the Betty and Barney Hill story, definitely go check out the Mad Scientist podcast, as he's doing a great investigation and series into the Betty and Barney Hill abduction, and definitely worth your time to check that out.
Travis's case is very appropriate for the sightings that were happening at the time and for the type of beings that were being seen. But I'll tell you, his is one of the more unique cases in that two different types of beings were encountered. And also, he had instant recall. He did not have to be regressed in any type of hypnosis to recall what he experienced. There was no attempt to subdue his own consciousness when he finally came to aboard that craft. What he saw, he was remembering and seeing. And he remembered at the moment he woke up on the side of the street.
So now this brings us back to Travis's return. It was a full 5 days later that Travis woke up in a phone booth at a gas station on the side of a highway. He called his brother-in-law, who eventually came and picked him up. And at this point, Travis was taken to get checked out by a private medical doctor. The doctor found him dehydrated and malnourished, yet he had no acetone in his urine, which I'm not a medical expert by any means, but I believe the acetone is from the body beginning to break down the muscle tissue. Otherwise, Travis had no other physical issues. However, he would have some severe post-traumatic stress stemming from the event. Of course, this stress didn't get any easier for Travis once the media and, of course, the debunkers got a hold of his story.
And that's always the typical case with debunking. It's these debunkers try to bring forth material that they think is evidence, but when you really look at it, you realize that it's it's facts they made up.
Tonight's episode is one in a series of UFO-themed shows that we're doing for the month of October. So this is for two reasons. One is to say thank you guys for all of your patience during our summer break. And also to remind you all to go to TravisWaltonTheMovie.com if you want a copy of the documentary that I referenced during this episode. There's also information there about a screening on Sunday, the 29th of October in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. So definitely go on there to check out all the information there. As always, don't forget about our partner sponsor, Fulton for Life, which is a perfect gift for the upcoming holiday season. So that's TravisWaltonTheMovie.com for your UFO needs and FultonForLife.com for your handbag and accessory needs. Going beyond the initial skepticism that the ultra-conservative town of Snowflake had, to be really honest, there wasn't a lot of initial evidence that pointed to a hoax on Travis's part. In fact, a lot of the air quote evidence against Travis in this case was presented by none other than Philip J. Class. Philip Class is a name that probably makes most people who research UFOs cringe. And mostly this is due to his MO of engaging in personal attacks rather than looking at the evidence in many UFO cases that he investigated. This, to me at least, is also what classifies him as more of a debunker rather than a skeptic. For our purposes, though, he was probably the biggest UFO debunker at the time and basically attacked the Travis Walton case for years. The biggest issue I personally had with him when it relates to this case was he offered Steve Pierce, who was also the youngest member of the crew, $10,000 to say his story was made up. Now, Steve ended up declining this offer, which to me says something in and of itself, that he would pass up $10,000. And it also makes me personally wonder why Class would spend so long attacking this case and put so much effort into a seemingly random UFO story. I'll let Jennifer tell you a little bit about her take on Philip Class and some of the things she was able to find.
Look at the Travis case and not deal with Philip Class. So I definitely did my own due diligence to read and educate myself about his tactics. And then I asked everyone that I interviewed, what was your interaction like with Philip Class? What's your opinion of him? You know, what do you know about his background? What do you think he was attempting to do? Why was he so interested in this case? What's your feelings and suspicions about Philip Class? And everyone I've talked to clearly, you know, came out with, oh, he worked for the NSA. He had to have been. And, of course, then I found evidence of that, and Travis has some evidence of that as well, an FBI file on Philip Class that reveals that he must have been part of some sort of clandestine group because they were themselves worried about him as a loose wire, that he didn't necessarily always know what he was talking about, and he would fly off, you know, his own handle, and that he was going to need to be watched. Plus, anyone who's listening, if they decide they want to go to the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia and read Donald Menzel's letters to Philip Class, you can read them. If you want to read the Philip Class file, it's there. You can read it. And even the fact that he has a file at the American Philosophical Society tells you something very important. Not everybody gets a personal letter, you know, archived file at a major institution like the American Philosophical Society. Why is it there?
Right.
It's there because the NSA wants to debunk this story, and they want people to know that Philip Class was this great man, and he spent his life investigating these files. And you can go in and you can read some of the letters, and it may make you think that, oh, well, yeah, he was really doing a good job being a critical skeptic. But if you spend 2 or 3 days there reading and you read all of his stuff, then you get the full picture. And the full picture is that he tried to manipulate and change the stories, attacked the people, looked at only part of the evidence, not all of the evidence, and invented things off the top of his head. He invented the idea that the boys on this logging crew were behind and they weren't going to meet their quota to get paid for the winter. And Philip went after this case and tried to debunk it with real vengeance for almost 20 years. I mean, it didn't stop. So that was fascinating to me. So I thought, you know, if you read Travis's book, he spends one third of the book talking about Philip Klass. It's the whole last third of the book. It's like a separate book in itself. So I thought, well, we can't make a documentary about the Travis Walton case and not really deal with Philip Klass. So I wouldn't say I spend a third of the film talk about Philip Klass, but I do spend a good 10 minutes out of 90, you know, dealing with who Philip Klass went after, who he consorted with, why he is a prime suspect of being possibly an NSA, National Security, you know, organization, or possibly CIA or FBI. He may have been part of one of those alphabet groups. I'm not sure. But he definitely was after this case, trying to debunk it in a big way.
Short of Klass, there's been really little that skeptics have actually used to claim the case was a hoax. The fact that guys got some money from the National Enquirer for their story was a big red flag for most people. For me personally, I think it was just a poor choice of media on the guy's part, but I'm sure anyone in their 20s would initially cash in on such an experience if given the chance. Now, for the record, I have not comfortably confirmed that this payment occurred, but I did read about it, so I wanted to put it out there. However, I do not put much credence in this particular aspect either way. Now, for you science types out there, which I know there's a few of you listening, there's actually new evidence in both soil samples and tree growth patterns.
There is one main thing, and it's in the newer version of the film. It's not in the first version that's for sale, but in this newer version that I'm trying to sell to a network. While we were doing our research with Ben Hansen, we decided we would do like a whole exploration of the actual site, you know, like 100 yards in every direction where this craft was. And we found some interesting, very large magnetic rocks on the soil that were full fist-size rocks, which we thought were interesting. We also found that the trees immediately surrounding the area, now it was already discovered that the trees grew faster where the craft had been, probably from some sort of radiation exposure. But what Travis and I discovered with Ben Hansen in the summer of 2014, when we went back to shoot that interview with Gillespie, and we went back to the forest, we discovered that the trees not only grew 33% more in the area where the craft had come down, but they grew more, even more, on one side of the tree facing where the craft was. So if you drew like an eccentric circle, the trees grew more on one side than the other.
Beyond the physical evidence, however, the part that Jennifer's documentary really does a great job diving into is the psychological impact this event had on the guys. Even if not asked directly, just hearing the guys tell their story from their own mouths really changes how you feel about the case. Or it did for me, at least, and I already believed in the story. Part of this storytelling, however, did include an attempt to try to spread the word a little bit more on Travis's part, which had Travis signing up to do a fictionalized account of his story with the Hollywood film Fire in the Sky.
Paramount Pictures actually did quite an elaborate fictionalization, I would call it, of Travis's story, based on his book that he was writing at the time but had not yet published. But it was always a disappointing film in many ways to Travis because of the fictionalization that they took liberty to do on that film. But they're Hollywood, and that's their job and their role, and they had to follow their orders from the execs above at the studio to make the film the way Paramount wanted it made. So there was really little choice in the matter, although I think Travis expected a more relevant and true telling of his experience, and maybe a more human side of the story captured in the Paramount film, but that really never happened.
Part of Travis's dissatisfaction with the Hollywood version of the film is what led to Travis partnering with Jennifer on her documentary, I think, from his perspective. However, I'm going to play a real quick clip about Jennifer's perspective and about how she met Travis Walton and some of the evolution of the movie itself.
And I've recently produced a film called Travis, The True Story of Travis Walton, which is a 90-minute documentary telling the true story of Travis's experience and the experience of the other men that were with him at the time of his very famous encounter with a UFO craft in the Sitgrave National Forest on November 5th, 1975. And I had the pleasure of meeting Travis. I was introduced to him in 2010 by a mutual friend named Peter Robbins, who is also an author, has written a book on the Rendlesham Forest event, and as well as a number of other books he's written. And he's a fabulous researcher and presenter. And we were running the Roswell conference together where Travis Walton was speaking. I was invited to have dinner with Travis along with Peter and a couple of the other speakers. And we were sitting around over a bottle of wine talking about how Roswell is such an important icon for those interested in studying the UFO world, whether you want to look at it just, you know, any way you want to approach it, the human side or the factual side on the ground or the evidence that continues to come out years and years later or the witnesses that come out years and years later. The Roswell story is a premier UFO story, and it's become a premier UFO conference. I mean, on some years, some anniversaries, over 10,000 people converged on that small town of Roswell. So over dinner in 2010, while I was sitting talking with Peter and Travis and said, you know, your story is as relevant as the Roswell story, involved a lot of people in the town that got behind looking for you and knew about your story, remember it. They were involved in search teams. There was a helicopter team out there. There was Navajo search and rescue looking for you. There were polygraphs involved. I mean, yours is a major story, and it involves the whole state of Arizona as well as a number of towns in northeastern Arizona where the event happened. We said to Travis, why don't you host a conference on an annual basis around your story? That would be a great thing to do, and it would be also maybe an economic boom for your little local area. So, you know, would you think about that? And Travis said, well, you know, it's the 35th anniversary this year in 2010. Maybe I should think about it for the 40th. So actually, Peter Robbins and I, having run some conferences together and being there to help orchestrate the Roswell conference, we decided to get behind it and help him begin to work towards that as sort of as coaches. I live in Philadelphia, so it's not like I have feet on the ground in Arizona, but, you know, I could advise him, make recommendations, make suggestions, and that's what happened. That's how I actually met Travis and how I began the process of making this film. In the conversations that Peter and I had with Travis, we began to realize that one of the things he envisioned for a 40th anniversary conference was to be able to take people back up into the woods where this event took place at night in November and just give them a sense of really what it was like for him and take them right to the spot where it happened. Even walking in at night with flashlights and what, I mean, how do you do that? You have to take people there before the sun sets, but then even after the sun sets, it's dangerous. And people could get lost trying to get back to where the bus is sitting. They could get attacked by a coyote, a wild boar, a moose. So I started to think, well, how about we go there in the summer and we film the area and we get the guys who were originally with you on the logging crew and we get them to talk. And we have that as our plan B, because logistically, I don't see how we're going to be able to pull this off, how we're going to be able to bring people up there in the forest. It's just, it to me, it's a logistical nightmare, and it's an insurance nightmare, in my opinion. We started out doing like a backup film that we could have in a conference center somewhere in the event that it snows or it's pouring rain. So if people had paid money to go there and now we couldn't deliver on what we promised as conference coordinators, I wanted to have a plan B. So the first film that I undertook with another film producer, God bless him, he's a great guy, his name is Bob Terrio, here from the Philadelphia area. We both ventured out there in August of 2013 And we shot and interviewed a couple of the guys, basically all three of the fellows came together that were living, that we could get a hold of, with Travis. So it was Steve Pierce, Kenny Peterson, and John Goulet. And we met them all separately because none of them could be there on the same day. They could all be there different days. So we had to spend a week there and interview each of them separately and go back to the woods with each one of them. So the first film that we actually produced is something called Tracking Sky Fire. And that's something that I give Bob Terrio 100% credit for. He did a fabulous job with this. So then after we got that film done in 2013, it occurred to me, I was running in 2014 a national conference here in Philadelphia for MUFON, and a number of the people we were bringing in were people very familiar with Travis's case and who had done research on it, like Stanton Friedman, Lee Spiegel, Ben Hansen, Kathy Martin, and a number of other people. So I decided to set them all down and interview them in a formal setting in a hotel in Philadelphia, and then take the footage I'd worked with Bob and kind of re-edit it together and make a more interesting, longer, more involved documentary, and then dig a little more into some of the archives and some of the tree evidence, and then also dig a little more into Philip Klass. So what I attempted to do in this film is invite the viewer in to get to know these people personally, all the people involved, including the police and the loggers and their families and, you know, whomever else. I really tried to get Travis's wife, Dana, to come on camera, but she was just too shy. Compliment, TJ. My goal in making this film was to make Travis human for people who don't understand the human side of the story. I mean, it is an amazing story, and you're going to get a lot of facts from this, but you also get what it does to people when this kind of thing happens to you. It ruins your life, and most of these guys would claim if they could go back and redo it, Travis says, I would have, if I'd known what was going to, my future was going to be after I jumped out of that truck, I never would have opened the door. I did tell you we are going to screen this film in the Philadelphia area. Travis is coming in to speak for a Pennsylvania MUFON conference that we hold every year in Bucks County. And if any of your listeners want to know more about that conference, they can go to MUFONPA.com. Just the word MUFON, M-U-F-O-N, stands for the Mutual UFO Network, and then PA for Pennsylvania.com. To my website, mainlinemufon.com, and also get information about the annual fall conference we do. And Travis will be in. He'll be presenting. And that'll be Friday and Saturday, October 27th and 28th. And then on the 29th, on Sunday, back in the Bryn Mawr area, which is right on the main line, we'll be screening this film and have a Q&A with Travis and myself and my other co-producer, Bob Terrio, will be there. And we'll screen the newest version of the film, and that'll be from 2 to 4 p.m. basically at the Barrack Hebrew Academy, which is right on Bryn Mawr Avenue in Bryn Mawr. And if people want information about that, they can get it both at the mainlinemufon.com site, or they can go to the film site called TravisWaltonTheMovie.com.
So after all of this, various movies, books, the one question that I personally have always had is very simple. Why?
I'd love to, because in actuality, when you think about it, TJ, and Travis has had his whole lifetime to think about this, right? That is the major question in everybody's mind. Since Travis's case is so unique, like, the, you know, obviously this craft wasn't out to capture them all. I don't even think it was out to capture any of them. I think it was accidental, and Travis thinks that too now after 40 years. So, you know, you have to ask yourself, well, look what happened. They killed him probably accidentally, and they took responsibility for it, and they brought him back to life, and then they brought him back to the planet. And they didn't mess with his memory. They, you know, was that deliberate? Was that somehow to show us humans that if they want to kill us, they can, and if they want to bring us back to life, they can? Was it deliberate for us to have this experience? Who knows? Or was it just accidental? most of us think it was just accidental. Travis was a damn fool. He got too close to a craft that was having probably some sort of malfunctioning issues.
I think at this point in the show, my take is pretty clear. But put an extra layer to your tinfoil hat, because here's what I think happened. I think there was a craft that was in the area, possibly keeping an eye on the nuclear testing being done at nearby military bases. It was about that time frame. The craft tried to leave when Travis and his crew approached the ship and accidentally hit him with a propulsion beam of some sort. Now, I agree with the theory that this likely killed him or severely injured him, so their explorer scientists, aka the Greys that he saw originally, took him back up onto the ship to fix him up and get him all back into working condition. When he woke up, the science or medical Grey aliens didn't really know what to do with a scared human being, so they got the bigger, stronger, and more human-looking Nordics to both calm him down and possibly physically restrain him if needed. Like I said, it's a pretty far out there theory for most of you, but based on my personal research into the UFOs and this particular case, it's a theory that now makes the most sense to me at least. And I think that's a perfect spot to end tonight's story. I hope you all check out Jennifer's website and film. Again, that's on TravisWaltonTheMovie.com for all the details there, as well as the details for the live screening in October in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. And of course, a huge thank you to Jennifer for talking with us and giving us her perspective on the case as well. We'll be back next week with another UFO story for UFO Month. But in the meantime, feel free to connect with me on Twitter at Pints and Puzzles or email at pintsandpuzzlespod@gmail.com. Our beer review is coming up right after a couple of quick promos for some of my amazing pod friends. Have a great night.
It was Paul Hellyer, the former Canadian Minister of Defense, that said, UFOs are as real as airplanes flying overhead. And here at the Our Strange Skies podcast, we're going to take that seriously. Starting in January, we'll be looking into UFO events, incidents, and myths that make up our American identity, from the pre-Roswell era to the post-Roswell era. We'll be covering some of the lesser-known incidents, like the Aztec UFO crash of 1948, John Everill's colonial UFO encounter, and Robert Richardson's 1967 brush with the Men in Black. We'll also be covering some of the more well-known incidents like the Roswell crash and doing in-depth profiles on people like J. Allen Hynek, Sergeant Clifford Stone, and many more. Look out for the Our Strange Skies podcast in January. In the meantime, don't forget to look up, because you never know what you'll find in Our Strange Skies. In Gray we trust.
Hey guys, this is Mandy and Melissa from Moms and Murder, a true crime podcast featuring two moms who think they're funny.
Trust us guys, we are. Join us each week as we discuss both the infamous and unfamiliar stories in the world of true crime.
You can check us out on our website at momsandmurder.com and also connect with us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.
We release new episodes on Tuesdays, so we hope you'll check us out.
Tonight's beer review is courtesy of my Great Lakes regional beer consultant, Kim Wilson. Yeah, that's what we'll call her. Kim was awesome enough to donate a few local beers to me the last time I saw her, so here's the first of those. Tonight we have Rochester Mills Beer Company Milkshake Stout. This delicious stout comes in at about a 5% ABV and is now on the list of my favorite milk stouts. It doesn't really have the sweetness of a typical milk stout. You really do have that thick, creamy beer. It has a nice roasted malt tones and just a touch of chocolate in the background. It's a really solid beer that lives up to its name, but isn't too sweet, so it doesn't taste like a milkshake. Don't let that part of the name scare you off. And apparently, according to the website, it has a blend of 7 proprietary malts. So it's got that going for it, which is nice. Have a great night.
That was pretty awesome. That was totes amazing. Wowers. That's really great.
Great.